Eddie, the Mechanic. Chapter 7. The Summer Reunion, Part 1. With the summer here, Eddie is putting in about 20 hours a week at Angelo's service station. A few familiar faces have come into the station over the last year, including some of Eddie's friends that he went to high school with. Angelo, taking Eddie's advice, has been getting a good return on his money in the stock market. But not everyone has a high regard for Eddie's advice. One such person is Mr. Crumb. While driving his Volkswagen Beetle one Saturday, Mr. Crumb is beginning to hear serious grinding sounds coming from his engine yet again. Even Mr. Crumb can tell that his engine is having a serious problem. Mr. Crumb drives into the service station and yells out to Angelo and Eddie, who are both working on vehicles in the shop, "The engine you put in is a lemon." Adding a bit of comedy to the day, Eddie whispers to Angelo, "I thought we put in an orange." Angelo replies, "Well, that guy is two grapes short of a fruit salad," pretty much calling Mr. Crumb an idiot. Eddie then tells Angelo, "Let me go and see what his problem is this time." Seeing Mr. Crumb in a tizzy, Eddie walks over to the office and asks the chronically irate high school principal, "Mr. Crumb, what a surprise. What can I do for you today?" Mr. Crumb replies, "The car. It sounds bad again. The new engine is a lemon." Eddie asks Mr. Crumb, "It sounds bad. What does it sound like?" Mr. Crumb replies, "The engine is making those grinding sounds again." Eddie, pretending to act pleasant, tells Mr. Crumb, "Well, let's go and take a look at it." Eddie walks out to Mr. Crumb's car and tells Mr. Crumb to start the engine. Mr. Crumb starts the engine, which sounds like the main bearings are again badly worn and in need of replacement. Eddie asks Mr. Crumb, "When was the last time you changed your oil?" Mr. Crumb replies, "After 500 miles, like you told me. And then again 6,000 miles later. You guys did the work. Don't you remember?" Eddie takes a look at the odometer, noticing there is a little more than 40,000 miles on the vehicle. Yanking Mr. Crumb's chain just for fun, Eddie mentions, "I can see what you mean. Your engine doesn't sound too good. Have you had it checked out by a mechanic?" Mr. Crumb exclaims, "That's why I'm here." Eddie replies, "I was just checking to see if anyone else looked at it." Eddie tells Mr. Crumb that he'll be right back and walks inside to talk with Angelo. Mr. Crumb is somewhat limited in the number of auto repair facilities that will service his vehicle. He has ticked off a few mechanics in the past and is no longer welcome at those shops. Eddie walks inside and tells Angelo, "Crumb's main bearings are gone again. He's only got 40,000 miles on that piece of shit. He must be doing something to it." Angelo laughs and replies, "Really? I've got to see this." As Eddie and Angelo walk out to Mr. Crumb's car, from a distance, Angelo can hear that the bearings are gone again. Hearing the bearings grinding, Angelo tells Eddie, "You're right. He's got to be doing something to that engine. It's not the engine. It's the driver that's the problem." Eddie warns Angelo, he's a bit angry. "He probably thinks it's our fault." Of course Mr. Crumb is angry. He came in angry, and Eddie added a little bit of fuel to the fire, purely for entertainment purposes. Normally, Angelo would tell Mr. Crumb to take a seat in the office and wait. But since Eddie has been giving Angelo some good stock tips, Angelo has made a considerable amount of money. Angelo now feels as if he can take a few minutes and see what kind of comedy Mr. Crumb is bringing to the station today. And with Eddie around, Angelo is now under a lot less stress. In a way, Eddie's unusual sense of humor has made Angelo's life a little less hectic and much less stressful. Mr. Crumb, seeing Angelo walking up, exclaims, "The engine you put in is a lemon." Angelo comments, "It sounds like your bearings are on their way out again. I wonder why that could be." Mr. Crumb replies, "Don't tell me that. The engine was just replaced. Eddie adds, well, it's obviously not the Johnson rod. I put in a stainless steel one. It should last a long time. Angelo turns around, pretending to listen to the engine more carefully to conceal his laughter. Once he regains his composure, Angelo tells Mr. Crumb to turn his engine off. Angelo, tired of Mr. Crumb's attitude over the years, asks, how often do you change your oil? Mr. Crumb replies, every 6,000 miles, like I'm supposed to. As Eddie is checking the oil, Angelo asks Mr. Crumb, how often do you check your oil? Mr. Crumb replies, every month or so. Angelo knows something must be going on. He replaced the bearings in the engine a few years ago, replaced the engine last year, and now the bearings sound like they are gone again. Eddie walks from the back of the car and shows Angelo the oil on the dipstick, noting that it is an unusual color. Eddie tells Mr. Crumb, your oil is a very interesting color. Who changed it last? Mr. Crumb yells, I told you. You guys did. Eddie asks, did you add any oil since the oil change? Mr. Crumb replies, yes. The 10W40, like you told me. And I put in an oil additive. Now, Eddie feels as if he is getting somewhere. Eddie and Angelo look at each other, both at a loss to understand what kind of oil additive, when added to oil, would give it a shiny silvery hue. Eddie asks Mr. Crumb, what kind of oil additive do you put in your oil? Mr. Crumb replies, I don't know the name of it. A regular oil additive, I guess. Eddie tells Mr. Crumb, really? Drive home, get your regular oil additive, and bring it back here. I need to see it. Eddie is quite sure that Mr. Crumb is not going to return with a bottle labeled regular oil additive. Truth be known, Eddie and Angelo are both secretly hoping that Mr. Crumb does not return at all. As Mr. Crumb drives home to get the bottle of his special oil additive, Eddie mentions to Angelo, I wonder what he's adding to his oil. Angelo replies, I don't know. But his engine sounds really bad again. And the bad news is his 4,000-mile warranty is out. Eddie comments, maybe he puts dishwashing detergent in it and makes his own detergent motor oil. Angelo laughs and replies, I wouldn't put it past him. That guy is a real piece of work. Eddie and Angelo get back to work, both wondering what kind of oil additive Mr. Crumb is using. Hoping earlier that Mr. Crumb would not return, Eddie and Angelo are not so lucky. Mr. Crumb returns with his automobile and his special oil additive that he has been adding to the oil. Mr. Crumb takes a seat and waits as Angelo is writing up a service ticket. Eddie walks into the office and Mr. Crumb, handing the bottle of oil additive to Eddie, exclaims, here it is. This is the oil additive. Eddie takes a look at the bottle, carefully reading the label. Eddie waits until the customer, for whom Angelo is writing the service ticket, leaves. Eddie can immediately tell that this conversation is going to be very interesting. The customer leaves, and Angelo asks Eddie, so, what do you got? Eddie tosses the bottle to Angelo and replies, that's his regular oil additive. Eddie tells Mr. Crumb, Mr. Crumb, what you are adding to your oil is a metal polish. Mr. Crumb abruptly interrupts Eddie, telling him, I know that. What do you think I am? Stupid. Eddie explains, Mr. Crumb, what's in that bottle is an abrasive metal polish. It's grinding away at the inside of your engine. No wonder your bearings are all shot again. And that silvery color of your oil is the inside of your engine being turned into microscopic metal dust. Mr. Crumb argues, moving parts are supposed to be polished. I read it in a magazine. Eddie rebuffs, yeah, polished at the factory. Angelo, reading the label on the bottle of metal polish, finally gets his answer as to why Mr. Crumb's engine is always prematurely failing. Not liking Eddie's answer, Mr. Crumb tells Angelo he doesn't know what he's talking about. Angelo firmly informs Mr. Crumb, yes, he does. You're pretty much putting liquid sandpaper into your oil. How much oil have you been adding to your engine? Mr. Crum replies, about a quart every 500 miles now. And I put some of the additive in each time I add oil. Eddie interjects, yeah, well now you need a ring job. And your valve guides are probably shot too. Angelo adds, not to mention the oil pump. Mr. Crum exclaims, can't you guys give me any good news? Eddie replies, no. Not if you put an abrasive metal polish in your oil. Angelo could just go back to work, but Mr. Crum is providing way too much comical amusement at the moment. And Angelo, knowing that Eddie has an unusual sense of humor, allows Eddie to direct the conversation. Mr. Crum asks, so, what do I do? Eddie replies, your engine needs to be rebuilt again. Mr. Crum asks, how long can I go before I have to do that? Eddie replies, let me think about this for a minute. Eddie pauses for a moment, pretending as if he is thinking, and replies, until about 60 seconds before it seizes up again. Angelo tries not to laugh at Eddie's comment, but is not too successful. Eddie tells Mr. Crum, if I were you, I'd get your oil changed immediately and get that abrasive shit out of your engine. But that's not going to fix the problem. Your engine still has to be rebuilt. And if you don't rebuild it soon, you'll be buying another new engine. Eddie asks Mr. Crum, let me ask you this. Have you put any of this metal polish in your transmission? Questioning Eddie, Mr. Crum replies, the transmission has oil in it. Eddie replies, yeah, it does. So, now I'm guessing that, since you didn't know there is oil in your transmission, you didn't put any of this metal polish in your transmission. Mr. Crum replies, no. I didn't put any in there. Eddie smiles and tells Mr. Crum, well, you wanted some good news, and there it is. Your transmission is probably fine. Angelo laughs, watching as Eddie mentally takes apart Mr. Crum. Mr. Crum, not too happy at the moment with the news he's received, asks, can you change my oil now? Not wanting to disrupt the schedule, Angelo interjects, yeah. In about an hour. Not liking the answer he received, Mr. Crum tells Angelo, I can't wait that long. I'll be back. Mr. Crum drives off, grinding away his bearings with his special oil additive that was never meant to be added to the oil. So, the mystery of Mr. Crum and his short-lived engine has finally been solved. Eddie will be back on the track team in the autumn, and it's time for him to reevaluate his workouts. Remembering how he got so fast to begin with, Eddie decides to head to Vito's bicycle shop to get a few new tires for his bicycle. Planning on riding his bicycle to work when the weather permits, getting in an extra 20 or 30 miles a week will help Eddie keep his competitive edge. And, throwing in a workout today, Eddie rides his bicycle to Vito's. Arriving at Vito's bicycle shop, Eddie finds a sign on the window stating that the shop will be closed for an indeterminate amount of time. The sign, an official-looking notice from some governmental organization, states that the operation of the business has been suspended. Looking through the window, Eddie sees the shop looks no different inside than he remembers from a month ago. Heading down the street to the pizzeria, Eddie hopes Joe might know why Vito's bicycle shop is closed. Eddie walks into the pizzeria, and Joe yells out, "Hey, Eddie! Where's everyone else?" Eddie replies, "I'm here by myself today." Joe asks, "What will it be today?" Not visiting for a meal today, Eddie asks, "I was wondering why Vito's is closed. There's a sign on the window that says it's closed for an indeterminate amount of time. Do you know anything about it?" Joe replies, "He's closed. That's news to me. Vito was in here for lunch one day last week. He ordered shrimp scampi and a salad. He didn't mention anything about closing when he came in." Eddie comments, "I hope he's okay. Maybe I'll ride by his house and check on him." Joe tells Eddie, "If you find anything out, let me know." Eddie replies, "Will do," and heads out to Vito's house, which is only about 4 miles away. Vito is outside, cutting his lawn, when Eddie arrives. Eddie, relieved to find out that Vito is physically okay, rides his bicycle in circles for a minute, cooling down after his 4 mile sprint. Looking up, Vito sees Eddie walking up the driveway with his bicycle. As he reaches down to turn off his lawnmower, Vito yells out, "Hey, Eddie. You're the last person I was expecting to see today." Getting right to the point, Eddie asks, "Hey, how come your shop is closed?" Vito's countenance suddenly drops as he tells Eddie, "Come over here and let's sit down for a minute." Eddie walks over, taking a seat in the shade on the front porch with Vito. Eddie asks Vito, "What happened? Why are you closed?" Vito explains, "Eddie, I'm no genius. I know a lot about bicycles. But I'm no businessman. I don't even know how I got by all these years." Not quite understanding what Vito is getting to, Eddie asks, "What happened? What are you talking about?" Vito continues, "The tax man shut me down. Whenever I sold something, I would tell the customer, that's $20 with the tax, or that's $80 with the tax. Eddie, I don't know how to figure out tax. All I know is that, if I order a part, and it costs me $10, I sell it for $20. If a bicycle costs me $100, I sell it for $200. So, I'm told that, until I get my books straightened out, file the proper tax forms, and pay the taxes they say I owe, they won't let me reopen." Vito confesses, "Eddie, I don't even have any books, and my records are a bunch of bills and receipts in a shoebox." Eddie can clearly see that Vito has no idea even where to begin to solve his problem. Eddie thinks back to when he got his first bicycle. Eddie, his parents, and Vito went outside to the back parking lot so Eddie could try the bicycle. Eddie, almost 4 years old at that time, rode away on the bicycle. Eddie's father and Vito had to run and chase Eddie down. Eddie knew that was the bicycle that he wanted Santa Claus to bring him for Christmas that year. Eddie remembers that Vito told him to make sure that he asks Santa Claus for a light for the bicycle too, in case it gets dark out when he's out riding. Later that month, on Christmas morning, that very bicycle was under the Christmas tree with Eddie's name on it. Eddie rode his bicycle every chance he got. Eddie's parents could not keep him off his bicycle. Eddie also thinks to himself that Ralph has just graduated from college and has an accounting degree. An accountant is exactly what Vito needs to help him out. Eddie tells Vito, "I might be able to help you with this problem." Vito tells Eddie, "Or, Eddie, you have your own life. I'll get this to work out somehow." Eddie explains, "Wait. Listen. I know this guy who just graduated from college with a degree in accounting. The guy is really, really smart. I'm sure he could get you out of this mess." Vito tells Eddie, "I don't know. I don't even know how big this mess is." Eddie replies, "Maybe it's a big mess to you, but it could be a small mess to an accountant." Giving Vito some advice, Eddie tries to persuade Vito, telling him, "When someone has a broken bicycle, they bring it to you, right? When they want to eat pizza, they go to the pizzeria. When their car breaks down, they bring it to Angelo. When you have an accounting mess, you find an accountant." Vito, who's been around for a while, already knows that, and replies, "Yeah, Eddie. I know. I know." Eddie didn't tell Vito anything he doesn't already know. Eddie then tells Vito, "But, think about all those kids who won't get to ride their bicycles because they are broken. And, when Christmas comes, they'll find a bicycle made with plumbing tubing under their Christmas tree." That was all Vito needed to hear to change his mind. Vito tells Eddie, "Okay, Eddie. You've convinced me. I'll give this guy a try." Eddie tells Vito, "I'll have him call you. His name is Ralph." Eddie then gets Vito's home phone number, writes down Vito's home address, and heads home. Vito has little tolerance for poorly built bicycles. Vito always referred to department store bicycles as bicycles made out of old plumbing tubing. He called the front forks of such bicycles almost suitable for a pry bar. On one occasion, when fixing one of these low-quality bicycles, Vito found that the bicycle came from the factory with no grease in the bearings. Eddie's reference to a bicycle made with plumbing tubing is all that Vito needed to hear to reconsider Eddie's offer. Arriving home, Eddie makes a phone call to Ralph. Eddie finds out that Ralph is still living at his parents' house and just started working at his father's accounting firm. Eddie asks Ralph if he can come over and discuss Vito's situation. Ralph agrees, so Eddie drives over to Ralph's house. Driving up in his MGB, Eddie notices that Ralph still has his Volkswagen Beetle. Eddie knocks on the door, and Ralph invites him in. After catching up on life for a few minutes, Eddie explains Vito's situation in detail to Ralph. Eddie then throws a generous offer on the table. Making the offer, Eddie explains, if you get Vito out of his mess, then you don't have to repay the money I loaned you last year. In shock, Ralph replies, "Are you serious?" Eddie replies, "Yeah. Totally serious." Ralph tells Eddie, "Sure. I'll be glad to help him out." Eddie then warns Ralph, "His accounting isn't too good. It could be a bigger mess than you think." Ralph reassures Eddie, "I'm sure my father has seen worse over the years." Eddie gives Ralph Vito's contact information. Ralph assures Eddie that he will call Vito in the next day and set up a meeting. Ralph figures that getting Vito out of a mess seems like a small price to pay for Eddie to write off a year of college tuition and expenses. And everyone in the area probably got a bicycle from Vito at one time or another. Vito's bicycle shop is not a business that the community can afford to lose. Just like with Kathy and Eddie, hiring a wedding planner certainly saved Mark and Paula quite a lot of time. They have both been busy over the last year with school and building their house. While they have done a lot of work planning their wedding, there was a lot more work to do than they ever expected. But Jennifer, the wedding planner, certainly made everything easy for Mark and Paula. Mark and Paula have planned their wedding to be on the beach, which will be much like Kathy and Eddie's wedding. They have considered other options, but they kept coming back to a beach wedding. But, knowing Paula, none of her friends really expected anything other than a beach wedding. Paula's extended family was surprised to hear of the beach wedding, but, with Paula's beach patrol jeep and her beach girl persona, a beach wedding was inevitable. When the weekend of their wedding arrives, everything is going according to plan. At the beach, the temperature is in the 80-degree range, with a clear blue sky. With a low surf and a light ocean breeze, it is a perfect day for a beach wedding. The altar, tents, and guest chairs are out on the beach. The reception room is ready to go, where the DJ is just finishing setting up his equipment. Jennifer, the wedding planner, is taking one last trip around the reception hall to make sure everything is perfect. In addition to the family and friends, Joe and Ariana, from the pizzeria, are on the guest list today. Among the other guests today are Vito, from the bicycle shop, Angelo, Mr. Fraser, Mr. Zunday, and Miss Amherst. And Paula's favorite auto body guy, Vinny, is also in attendance today. Knowing that Paula is also Italian, Vinny always rolls out the red carpet for her. Paula has clearly become Vinny's favorite customer. The guests begin to arrive and walk out to the beach where everything is ready to go. The bridesmaids and groomsmen are patiently waiting in their tents. Paula and Mark's music selections are playing in the background as everyone waits anxiously for the ceremony to begin. Leaving from the bridesmaids' tent, walking down the aisle, is Paula's matron of honor, Kathy. Kathy is followed by the bridesmaids, who are Barbara, Wendy, Amber, Erica, and Tessa. Once they are set and in position, the groomsmen walk out from their tent. Led by Mark, Eddie, the best man, is followed by Johnson, Braden, Mitchell, Bobby B., and Hoffa. Paula's wedding attire is a white sundress, adorned with much lace, and white sandals. Paula's bridesmaids are all wearing a yellow-orange sundress, similar to the color of the sun on Paula's Jeep, and yellow sandals matching Paula's style. Mark is wearing white silk pants, complemented with a light blue shirt, matching the color of Paula's Jeep. The groomsmen are wearing light blue arena warm-up suits, also matching the color of Paula's Jeep. Once the wedding party is all in position, the DJ fades out the music and plays the piece Paula chose to walk down the aisle by. As the composition Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring, as performed by Danielle Licari, begins to play, Paula stands at the end of the aisle. After hearing the voice of Danielle Licari during Kathy's wedding, Paula fell in love with the singer's style. The guests stand, as all heads turn to catch their first glimpse of the bride. Mark, along with the rest of the wedding party, smiles as Paula walks down the aisle, approaching the altar. Paula meets Mark at the altar, holding his hand, and the ceremony begins. As the music fades out, Dr. Christobuez Akinmola, officiating today's ceremony, announces, "I am so honored that Paula and Mark saw it fit for me to officiate their wedding ceremony today. I have known them for a long time, and I am so very glad to be here today, as I'm sure all of you are. I greet all of you on this beautiful day in the name of Jesus Christ our Lord." Dr. Akinmola announces, "We are gathered here today, with God among us, to join this man, Mark Svoboda, and this woman, Paula Giovanni, in holy matrimony. Let us open with prayer. Dearly beloved, we have come together in the presence of God to witness and bless the joining together of Mark and Paula in holy matrimony. The bond and covenant of marriage was established by God in creation, and our Lord Jesus Christ adorned this manner of life by his presence and first miracle at the wedding in Cana of Galilee. It signifies to us the mystery of the union between Christ and his church, and Holy Scripture commends it to be honored among all people. The union of husband and wife is intended by God for their mutual joy, for the help and comfort given to each other in prosperity and adversity, and when it is God's will, for the procreation of children, and their nurture in the knowledge and love of the Lord. Therefore, marriage is not to be entered into unadvisedly or lightly, but reverently, deliberately, and in accordance with the purposes for which it was instituted by God." Dr. Akinmola continues, "This is a very special day in the lives of Paula and Mark. Paula and Mark have chosen to have a passage from 1 Corinthians 13 read for their ceremony. Please be stilled in your spirit as I read from God's word." Dr. Akinmola reads, "Love is patient. Love is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not boast. Love is not proud. Love is not rude, it is not self-seeking, and it is not easily angered. Love keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. Love always protects, always trusts, always hopes, and always perseveres. Love never fails." Dr. Akinmola continues, "Paula, will you have Mark to be your husband, to live together with him in the covenant of marriage? Will you love him, comfort him, honor and keep him, in sickness and in health, and, forsaking all others, be faithful unto him as long as you both shall live?" Paula, with tears of happiness flowing down her face, replies, "I do." Turning toward Mark, Dr. Akinmola continues, "Mark, will you have Paula to be your wife, to live together with her in the covenant of marriage? Will you love her, comfort her, honor and keep her, in sickness and in health, and, forsaking all others, be faithful unto her as long as you both shall live?" Looking into Paula's eyes, Mark replies, "I do." Placing Paula's wedding ring on her finger, Mark tells Paula, "Paula, I give you this ring as a symbol of my love, and with all that I am, and all that I have, I honor you, in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit." Paula then places Mark's wedding ring on his finger, telling him, "Mark, I give you this ring as a symbol of my love, and with all that I am, and all that I have, I honor you, in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Dr. Akinmola proclaims, Bless, O mighty Lord, these rings as a symbol of Mark's and Paula's vows by which they have bound themselves to each other, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Dr. Akinmola then proclaims, By the power of God, and by the power given to me by the state, I now pronounce you husband and wife. Those whom God has joined together let no one put asunder. Paula and Mark smile, and gaze deeply into each other's eyes, both waiting for this moment for a very long time. Dr. Akinmola, blessing the couple, prays, May God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit, bless, preserve, and keep you. May the Lord mercifully, with his favor, look upon you, and fill you with all spiritual benediction and grace, that you may faithfully live together in this life, and in the age to come having life everlasting. Amen. Dr. Akinmola announces, You may now kiss your bride. Mark and Paul kiss each other, giving each other a big hug. Paula looks at Mark, with the biggest and warmest smile that anyone has ever seen on her. The guests cheer, many of them knowing that Paula has been waiting for this day for a while. Dr. Akinmola announces, I now present to you Mr. and Mrs. Svoboda. Mark and Paula walk down the aisle, holding hands as they walk toward the beach. Once Paula and Mark are at the end of the aisle, they head toward the bride's tent. The groomsmen and bridesmaids leave next, led by Eddie and Kathy. They are followed by Johnson and Barbara, Braden and Wendy, Mitchell and Amber, Bobby B., and Erica, and finally Hoffa and Tessa. The ushers usher Paula's and Mark's parents and grandparents down the aisle through the sand. Paula's and Mark's family and the wedding party hang around for a while on the beach while Emily, the photographer, takes as many photographs as she can. Following the photographic session, Paula and Mark walk through the sand to the reception. Mark and Paula could have taken the dune buggy, but they opted to walk. The guests, who have been waiting for the bride and groom, clap and cheer when Paula and Mark walk through the door. Paula tells Mark, A year ago, we were standing right here, and I remember saying I would love to get married on the beach. Mark replies, And we did it. Here we are. Paula and Mark kiss again, prompting the guests to cheer. Eddie tells Braden and Mitchell, This is where me and Kathy had our wedding last year. Braden comments, I'm so sorry that I missed that. I was probably in the middle of failing my physical exam when you guys were getting married. Eddie replies, You know, Kathy's really glad that you failed your physical. She really wants the team back together again. Mitchell comments, Yeah, I kind of noticed that. Wendy tells Eddie, Last year, I was all moved into my apartment, and I got a summer cold, and missed your wedding. And now I realize I don't want to leave this area. Amber, who was at Kathy and Eddie's wedding, bumps Mitchell's hip with hers, and tells everyone, Beach weddings are the best. Don't you think? Amber may have just given Mitchell a slight hint. When it is time for the bride and the groom to have the first dance, the DJ announces, Okay, everyone. It is time for Paula and Mark to have the first dance. Paula and Mark, please come up to the dance floor. The guests all cheer as Paula and Mark make their way to the dance floor. The DJ continues, playing Mark and Paula's selection for their first dance, Love Will Keep Us Together, by The Captain and Tennille, which Paula and Mark chose together. There is no doubt that this will not be a slow dance. The DJ starts the music, and Paula and Mark get down. During the newlyweds' first dance, Jennifer, the wedding planner, runs into a slight problem at the door. Two guys, both in dripping wet swimsuits, who were not invited to the wedding, make their way into the reception hall. Jennifer tells them, This is a closed event. You'll have to leave. One of them demands that they be let in because it is a public space. Jennifer follows them, insisting, You guys will have to leave. This is a private party. The two guys ignore Jennifer's request, making their way into the reception hall. The slight problem has turned into Jennifer's worst nightmare, a wedding crasher. Leaving a trail of water on the floor behind them, the two intruders make their way over to the spread of hors d'oeuvres. They help themselves to whatever they want, and if they don't like the taste of what they picked up, they rudely throw it on the floor. Trying not to disrupt the reception, Jennifer quietly exclaims, "You too. Leave immediately." Neither of them leaves as instructed, but rather make their way to the table with the pizza. Each indulging on a slice of pizza, they apparently have invited themselves to stay for lunch. Jennifer is now livid, frantically looking around for anyone who can help. Hearing the commotion, Braden gazes over to see what might be the problem. Seeing what is going on, Braden tells Eddie, "I think we got a little problem." Eddie looks over and sees McCutcheon and Leggett working their way through the spread of food. Hearing Jennifer trying to persuade the intruders to leave, Eddie tells Braden, "It looks like we have some work to do." Braden smiles and replies, "Let's go and take care of their asses." Eddie and Braden exchange a fist bump and get to work. Eddie and Braden briskly walk over and quickly intercept McCutcheon and Leggett. Braden, exercising authority as he learned it at the police academy, asks Jennifer, "What's going on here?" Jennifer exclaims, "These two guys are crashing the wedding. I asked them to leave, but they continued to walk in." Braden looks at McCutcheon and Leggett, telling them, "I suggest both of you turn your ass around and walk out that door right now." In no uncertain terms, McCutcheon tells Braden, "It's a public building. I'm not leaving." Braden replies, "If you don't walk out right now, I'm gonna carry your sorry ass out." McCutcheon ignores Braden's demand and proceeds to finish his slice of pizza. Bobby B. and Johnson walk up. Bobby B. asks, "What's up?" Braden replies, "It looks like we got some trash to take out." McCutcheon and Leggett try to walk around the 1,000-pound defensive line to get another slice of pizza, but the four track stars block them from going any further. Leggett pushes Eddie, prompting Bobby B. to pick up Leggett and throw him over his shoulder. Braden follows suit and picks up McCutcheon, throwing him over his shoulder as they head for the door. Eddie and Johnson run ahead of them, opening the door so the trash can be taken out. McCutcheon and Leggett perhaps forgot all about the day in the gym this past winter when their physical deficiencies were made apparent by Eddie and his friends. Braden and Bobby B. carry McCutcheon and Leggett through the parking lot. Bobby B. asks Braden, "What do you want to do with them?" Braden suggests, "How about we try them out as a hammer?" Bobby B. grins and replies, "That sounds good to me, bro." Braden and Bobby B. carry the wedding crashers out to the beach, where they will compete in the hammer throw. Unfortunately for McCutcheon and Leggett, they will be the hammers. On the way, Leggett is punching Bobby B., albeit quite ineffectively. Bobby B. comments, "I think this guy is trying to punch me, but I can't really tell." Braden laughs and tells Bobby B., "Maybe a fly landed on your back." Bobby B. laughs and replies, "Yeah, that must have been it." McCutcheon tells Leggett, "When they put us down, we'll take care of them." Braden laughs and comments, "Yeah, right. I really want to see that." Once they are near the water, Braden and Bobby B. body slam McCutcheon and Leggett into the sand. Braden tells them both, "If I see either of your asses in there again, you ain't gonna be so lucky next time. Now, get ready for your first track and field lesson in the hammer throw." Braden grabs McCutcheon's ankles and spins him around like a hammer. Once Braden gets enough velocity, he releases McCutcheon, who sails through the air, crashing into the water. Bobby B. exclaims, "Good shot." Bobby B. tells Leggett, "Okay, it's your turn, Junior." Leggett tries to stand up and run away, but Braden quickly restrains him. Bobby B., who has thrown the hammer many times in the past, takes Leggett by the ankles, spinning him around. Getting some good momentum, Bobby B. releases Leggett, hurling him into the water. As Leggett crashes into the ocean, Braden gives Bobby B. a high five, telling him, I think you won this one, bro. Bobby B replies, yeah, but my hammer was a little lighter. We'll call it a tie. Brayden and Bobby B exchange another high five and head back in to join the party. Leggett and McCutcheon swim toward shore, not quite enjoying their first track and field experience in the hammer throw. At the door, Brayden tells Eddie, Bobby B, and Johnson, I'd better stay out here and watch them. They may try to get in again or mess with someone's car. Brayden is particularly concerned since Paula's Jeep is right in front of the building, which is already decorated for when she and Mark drive away. Eddie replies, I'll stay out here with you, bro. Johnson suggests, me and Bobby B will come out in 10 minutes and give you some relief so you can enjoy the party too. Having taken care of business, the group exchanges fist bumps and Johnson and Bobby B head inside. Jennifer steps outside and tells Brayden and Eddie, I'm so sorry that you guys had to deal with that. Occasionally, we get a wedding crasher. Those two guys were really a piece of work. Brayden smiles and tells Jennifer, no problem. It was my pleasure. Jennifer replies, thank you guys so much for handling that situation. I appreciate it so much. Brayden then informs Jennifer, we're gonna stand guard at the door until they are long gone. You shouldn't have to deal with them. If they come back, we'll take care of them. Jennifer, glad to hear that peace has been restored, heads back inside, where everything seems to be again going smoothly. Mark and Paula, catching a glimpse of what went on when McCutcheon and Leggett tried to disrupt the party, walk over to Johnson to find out what was going on. Mark asks Johnson, what was that all about? Johnson informs Mark, McCutcheon and Leggett tried to crash the party. We put a quick end to that. Eddie and Brayden are standing guard at the door. We'll go and relieve them in a while. Paula, trying to keep her voice low, exclaims under her breath, that piece of shit. Mark tells Paula, hey. Don't worry about McCutcheon and Lugnut. They'll work them over if they come back. Paula replies, oh, they are coming back. Mark whispers to Paula, I hope that's not your superpower at work. Paula finds Kathy and, after filling her in on what happened, tells Kathy, McCutcheon and Leggett aren't done with their pranks. I can feel it. So, Mark said, I really hope that's not your superpower at work. Paula then tells Kathy, please tell Eddie and Brayden to keep a really good eye on McCutcheon and Leggett. Kathy replies, will do. And, don't worry about it. Today's your wedding day. Calm down, girl. The guys will take care of them if they return. You just have fun. Kathy walks outside, filling in Eddie on what Paula asked to relay to him, as Brayden is walking the parking lot. Eddie informs Kathy, Paula is probably right. They haven't left yet. Pointing over toward the water, just beyond where a large family is having a picnic on the beach, Eddie tells Kathy, they're right over there, sitting on their towels, drinking something. And it doesn't look like they're going anywhere anytime soon. Kathy comments, McCutcheon makes Chucky look like a walk in the park. Eddie tells Kathy, everyone has their weakness. McCrutchen's weakness is his own mind. Kathy walks back inside and assures Paula that everything is under control. Paula and Mark cut their wedding cake together. Locking their arms, they give each other the first bite of cake. Paula and Mark's cake is 4 tiers, with 2 tiers of white cake and 2 tiers of chocolate cake. The chocolate tiers were Paula's idea, since chocolate, in addition to pizza, seems to be her favorite indulgence. After Paula and Mark have their slice of wedding cake, a line forms so everyone can get their slice. Kathy and Wendy get an extra slice of cake, bringing a slice out to Eddie and Brayden, who are working their shift patrolling the parking lot. Since it is getting hot outside, Eddie and Brayden make their way inside and eat their slice of cake so the frosting doesn't make a mess. They watch through the door, looking for signs of trouble. Brayden tells Eddie, I just thought of something. If they are gonna do something, it's gonna be now because they see that we're gone. Eddie replies, that's a good point, and asks, did you learn that at the police academy? Brayden replies, yeah. Sometimes, you want to give the impression that you've taken your guard down. That's when they move in, and then you make the bust. Eddie and Brayden enjoy their slice of cake, talking more about what Brayden learned at the police academy. Kathy and Wendy come over and talk with Eddie and Brayden. Brayden asks Wendy, would it be too much trouble to get me another slice of cake? Wendy replies, sure, no problem, as she takes Brayden's empty plate. Eddie asks Kathy, can you get me one too? Already knowing how Eddie will answer, Kathy asks, chocolate or vanilla? Eddie replies, chocolate, with lots of frosting. As Kathy and Wendy walk away to get Eddie and Brayden another slice of cake, Eddie peeks out through the window. Eddie tells Brayden, you were right. Here comes trouble again. Brayden looks through the window and tells Eddie, just let them come. Once they walk in, we have just cause to act. Seeing that Johnson is standing with Barbara, Brayden yells out, hey, Johnson. Johnson turns toward Brayden, and Brayden waves, signaling Johnson to come to the door. Bobby B., Hoffa, and John catch wind of what is about to happen, and also move toward the door. The door opens, and McCutcheon and Leggett stagger in. Brayden, immediately taking control of the situation, asks, what did I tell you two assholes before? With his voice sounding a bit on the slurred side, Leggett replies, you ain't telling us where we don't go. In a raised voice, Brayden exclaims, asking, have you been drinking? Leggett replies, that ain't not none of your business. Johnson comments, he's drunker than a skunk. Eddie takes a look at McCutcheon and whispers to Johnson, no wonder his times are so erratic on the track. Half the time, he's probably running with a hangover. Overhearing Eddie, McCutcheon exclaims, shut up, or I'll kick your ass. Leggett attempts to throw a punch at Brayden, who quickly intercepts Leggett's arm, forcing him into an arm lock. Leggett exclaims, let me go. I am going to kick your ass. Brayden tells him, go ahead. I'm waiting. Brayden announces, someone call the police and tell them to bring the wagon. Eddie makes the call as Brayden and Bobby B. escort the two perpetrators outside. As he is being dragged outside by Bobby B., McCutcheon yells out, you guys better let us go. Bobby B. laughs and tells McCutcheon, maybe we will. Just like we did before, right into the ocean. Outside, Leggett exclaims, let me go. Tightening the arm lock, Brayden tells Leggett, you ain't going nowhere, Junior. Leggett lets out a scream, prompting Brayden to tell him, shut your puny ass up, or I'll show you what real pain is. With Leggett and McCutcheon drunk and restrained, Brayden tells everyone, we can't let them go. They are drunk. They could get behind the wheel and kill someone. And they are so drunk that, if they stay on the beach, they could pass out. We'll just wait until the uniform guys get here. Eddie returns outside, telling Brayden, they are on their way. While they are all standing outside waiting for the police, Mark steps outside for a moment. Mark looks McCutcheon and Leggett in their eyes, and tells them, today is my wedding day. Just remember this, you piles of shit. Paybacks are hell. And, trust me, it will come. And, when it does, it will be the worst day of your lives. As Mark walks back inside, Brayden tells McCutcheon and Leggett, I'd hate to be on the other side of that ass kicking when it comes down. It sounds to me like Mark just made you two assholes a big promise. Eddie tells Brayden, and trust me, Mark will keep his promise. While they are waiting for the police, Eddie starts messing with McCutcheon, asking Brayden, hey, when you took out that goldshit guy, how long did that take? Brayden thinks for a moment and replies, I think it was somewhere around 10 or 15 seconds. Eddie asks, what exactly happened to goldshit? Braden boasts he's has ended up with a broken jaw, a fractured skull, and a dislocated shoulder. He needed two surgeries to get his ass moving again. And his ass still ain't right. Eddie tells McCutcheon and Leggett, wow. Aren't you guys lucky? Catching on, Braden asks Eddie, what happened to the Chucky when you kicked his ass after he threw the javelin at you? Eddie replies, wow. Let me think. The Chucky got a broken nose, three broken ribs, two broken arms, and a broken hip. He also got a neck sprain, and was in one of those neck braces for over a month. And the Chucky ended up with a broken jaw and six broken teeth. And something must have happened to his brain. He hasn't been right since. Johnson laughs and comments that Geysers has never been right. Hearing Eddie and Braden's exchange, McCutcheon yells out to Braden, hey. I'm not afraid of you. Braden, as he is maintaining Leggett in an arm lock, turns toward McCutcheon, looks him in the eye, and loudly yells out, boo. McCutcheon is suddenly startled, prompting Eddie, Bobby B., and Johnson to laugh. Purely for entertainment purposes, Braden asks McCutcheon, by the way, Junior, what was your ass doing on the track during the high school meet? McCutcheon does not venture to answer, but rather yells at Braden, telling him, shut up, and let me go. Eddie pipes up, answering for McCutcheon, he's obviously not any good at the college level. So, he's back running in high school. Braden tells Eddie, his ass ain't even good enough for middle school either. Eddie laughs, knowing that Braden's assessment is not far from the truth. The police arrive, driving up and parking in the lane near the door. Getting out of the car, the officers can clearly see the problem. Walking up cautiously, the senior officer asks, okay, what's going on here? Braden opens by saying, hi. I'm Officer Axel Braden. My assignment is at the State University. The two officers are immediately relieved, knowing that the situation is at least being handled by a professional. As Braden shows the officer his badge, he explains, these two guys crashed the party twice. I would have just kicked them out, but now they are both drunk. I didn't want them to get behind the wheel. And it's getting hot outside. They could pass out on the beach, or who knows what else. The senior officer tells Braden and Bobby B., okay, you can release them now. The senior officer asks Leggett and McCutcheon, have you two been drinking? McCutcheon, who is clearly drunk, replies, I might have had one beer. The senior officer asks Leggett and McCutcheon, do you see that white line? They both respond, yeah. Pointing to Leggett, the officer commands Leggett, you first. Walk it. Leggett walks the line, staggering along, not being able to walk a straight line. The officer then commands McCutcheon, okay, your turn. Walk the line. McCutcheon tries to walk the line, but staggers and nearly falls over. The rookie officer tells Leggett and McCutcheon, okay, both of you. Out with your ID. The senior officer pulls Braden aside, telling him, you made a good decision calling us. What's the 411 on them? Braden explains, there's a wedding reception going on inside. These guys go to the university and decided to crash the party. We escorted them out once, but they returned about an hour later. When they came inside the second time, they were drunk. So, we restrained them and called you guys. The officer asks Braden, was there any altercation? Braden replies, yes sir, there was. Leggett, the taller one, threw a punch at me, but I blocked it, and put him into an arm lock. That's how we ended up where we are. The senior officer tells Braden, okay. We'll take it from here. Braden tells the officers, it's nice to meet you guys. I appreciate your help. The officers arrest Leggett and McCutcheon and take them away. Everyone then goes back inside to enjoy the party, this time in peace. When they get back inside, Kathy tells Eddie, the next time we have a track party at the house, Remind me to leave those two assholes off the list. Eddie replies, I don't think they'd show up even if they were invited. Eddie then asks, so, what did I miss? Kathy replies, all the girly stuff, like throwing the bouquet and garter. Oh, and you missed the toast. Kathy asks, what did I miss? Eddie replies, Officer Braden had McCrutchen and Lug Nut arrested and taken away. Kathy comments, in a way, I'm sorry I missed that. I can't wait until track practice in a few weeks. Eddie reminds Kathy, oh yeah. I guess I'll be there too. That's going to go over real well. Mixing a little business with pleasure, Eddie asks Vito, so, did you meet with Ralph? Vito explains, Eddie, I did. Things are beginning to look a little brighter now. I gave Ralph all the papers, bills, and everything I had, and he told me that it doesn't really look too bad. Eddie replies, well, that's some really good news. Vito thanks Eddie, telling him, thank you for helping me out. I don't know what I would have done if you didn't get Ralph to help me out. Eddie replies, hey, someday I might have an Eddie Jr. running around. I'm counting on you to be there when it comes time to buy him his first bicycle. Vito smiles and asks, Eddie, are you telling me something? Eddie replies, no. There's no little Eddie on the way yet. Finally getting their chance to talk, Mr. Fraser and Braden step aside. Mr. Fraser asks, I remember you were planning on joining the Navy. I heard through the grapevine that you're back, and we didn't get much of a chance to talk at the state meet. What happened? Mr. Fraser has already heard the story from Kathy, but wants to hear it directly from Braden. Braden explains, I failed the physical exam because I'm colorblind, so they wouldn't let me in the Navy. So, I went to the police academy instead. And now I got a job at the university as a police officer. And next season, I get to run with the team. And I'll be getting a degree in criminal justice. Mr. Fraser gives Braden a fist bump, telling him, great job. Mr. Fraser remembers that Braden, during his 4 years of high school, broke up many fights and kept the peace. Mr. Fraser is very glad to hear that Braden has chosen an appropriate career path. After they've been talking for a while, Mr. Fraser couldn't help but to ask Braden, what was all that commotion out there earlier? Braden explains, McCrutchen and Leggett crashed the party. The first time, me and Bobby B took them out to the beach and tried them out as a hammer. We landed there as into the ocean. Mr. Fraser laughs and interrupts, telling Braden, I wish I could have been there to see that. Braden continues, then, about an hour later, both of their asses came back, all drunk. So, we called the police, and they took them away in a wagon. We won't be seeing them again. Mr. Fraser asks, McCrutchen. Isn't that the guy who ran for Centerville? Braden replies, yeah. That's the guy. And that's the guy who tried to sneak into the invitational meet without an invitation and run in his brother's place. But that's not the real problem. The problem is McCrutchen goes to the university and he's on the track team. And so is that Leggett guy. I can see how well that's gonna go over when practice starts in the fall. Mr. Fraser reminds Braden, you guys can handle it. McCrutchen is a drop in the bucket compared with what Mr. Crumb put you guys through. Even Mr. Fraser calls McCrutchen McCrutchen now. Mr. Fraser is glad to hear that Braden is back and will be running for the university. Mr. Fraser is also glad to hear that Braden will be getting a degree in criminal justice. The party winds down, and it's time for Paula and Mark to leave. The guests line up, forming a path out to the Jeep. As they walk out, birdseed flies everywhere. As Paula and Mark approach the Jeep, the tribe gives Paula and Mark high fives, fist bumps, and hugs. Mark helps Paula into the Jeep, not that she really needed help. Mark gets behind the wheel, and they wave as they prepare to drive away. Mark and Paula drive away in Paula's beach patrol jeep, driving down the beach to the parking lot 2 miles away. From there, they'll get back on the road. Everyone waves as the newlyweds drive down the beach together. Many of the guests are wondering where they are going. Mark and Paula have frequented this beach, along with Eddie and Kathy, for 5 years. They know exactly where they are going. With Paula and Mark heading down the beach, the party winds down. Eddie's brother snatches a few slices of pizza while the adults all say goodbye to each other for the afternoon. The track team members head outside, with Eddie's brother joining them, and take a casual walk toward the ocean. As she is walking down the beach with the rest of the group, Kathy is looking down at a large collection of shells and rocks that have washed ashore during high tide. Eddie asks Kathy, "Are you looking for shells?" Kathy replies, "No. I'm looking for a blue stone. But I haven't found exactly what I'm looking for yet." Eddie takes a brief look, not seeing any blue stones either. The group turns around and heads back to the party, finding many people heading out. The tribe is among the last to head out, as Paula and Mark are on their way to their honeymoon. When Paula and Mark return from their honeymoon, their house will be almost ready. The inside of their house is finished and ready for them to begin their life together when they return. Mark and Paula have been working hard at getting the outside finished. While the landscaping in the backyard is completed and the pool is ready, the front yard remains unfinished. The landscaping in the front can use a lot of work, since there really is none to speak of. While Mark is away, Eddie hires his brother, John, to install the landscaping in the front yard. Eddie is nice enough to give John a little help. Eddie has the gravel driveway removed and, with the help of his and Mark's father, sets the forms for paving the driveway. In the middle of the week, more than a dozen cement trucks arrive to pave the 200-foot driveway and parking area in front of Mark's separate detached three-car garage. By the end of the week, the front of the house looks drastically different from before. John made out really well during that week, making more money than in an entire summer of cutting lawns. A week later, Paula and Mark return very late on Sunday night. Mark pulls into the driveway, knowing ahead of time that Eddie was going to oversee the completion of the project. Paula quickly tells Mark, "This isn't our house. We have a gravel driveway." Mark replies, "Surprise." Paula carefully looks at the driveway, seeing as much as the headlights can expose. As they get closer, Paula exclaims, "We have bushes." Mark replies, "Surprise." Paula asks, "When did all this get done?" Mark explains, "I had my dad, Eddie's father, Eddie, and John finish it up while we were away. Everything's all done. So, we can wake up tomorrow and sit by the poolside." Paula, who thought she'd be trying to get the yard finished before autumn semester begins, exclaims, "Awesome." Paula and Mark head inside, ready to spend their first night at home. Summer also brings with it the annual rematch between Eddie and Tessa in the pool. Everyone waited until Mark and Paula returned from their honeymoon before having this year's reunion. Last year, in the pool, Eddie won. This year, Tessa has vowed to beat Eddie, but also knows that, if she does win, Eddie has been slacking off. A little more than a year ago, Eddie unofficially broke the high school state record in both the 50-yard and 100-yard men's freestyle. This year, however, will bring more than a rematch in the pool. Some of the members of the tribe haven't seen each other as much this summer, so this year at the pool will be a reunion of sorts. Eddie and Kathy arrive, seeing that Tessa and Hoffa are already at the pool. Mark and Paula have already arrived, as have Johnson and Barbara. As they walk up to the table, Kathy notices Tessa has a curiously beautiful smile. Before Kathy could say anything, Tessa exclaims, "Guess what?" Kathy replies, "Whatever it is, your smile is telling me it's good news." Not being able to wait to make the announcement, Tessa exclaims, "I got a swimming scholarship." Kathy and Eddie both exclaim, "Awesome!" Impatient, and wanting to know, Kathy asks, "To where? To what school?" All excited, Tessa replies, "Yours." Kathy then asks Hoffa, "Does this mean?" Before Kathy can finish her question, Hoffa replies, "Yeah. I accepted their offer." Kathy and Eddie give Hoffa and Tessa a high five, all glad that Hoffa will be on the university track team next year. Bobby B. arrives, but without Erica on the back of his motorcycle this year. Erica has bought her own motorcycle and rode in right behind Bobby B. Erica and Bobby B. walk up to the table, also wasting no time wanting to find out whether Tessa got a scholarship. Erica, who knows the university was interested in Tessa, asks, "Well, did you get it?" Tessa replies, "I sure did." Erica gives Tessa a high five, knowing this means that Hoffa will be on the track team with her. Braden arrives next with Wendy. Everyone cheers and gives Wendy a hug when she walks up. Everyone briefly saw Wendy during Paula and Mark's wedding. Wendy has been sort of out of the loop for the last year, attending a community college that is far away. Hearing that Braden is returning to the area and will be attending the university, Wendy made application to transfer. Wendy announces to everyone, "I got accepted to the university, and all my credits transfer. I'm starting in the fall." Kathy exclaims, "That's awesome. I didn't know you were going to transfer." Wendy tells Kathy, "Well, I didn't want to say anything in case I didn't get accepted." There is really no reason why Wendy wouldn't have gotten accepted. She graduated from high school summa cum laude and got straight A's in her first year in college. Mitchell drives up with Amber, bringing Akinmola along with them. As they walk up, Paula announces, "Hey, the rest of the distance team is here." Eddie, seeing no sweat on Akinmola's clothing, exclaims, "Hey, check it out. He finally did it." Kathy asks, "Who did what?" Eddie replies, "Akinmola took a ride from someone." Taking a seat, Akinmola explains, "Mitchell came by to see if I wanted a ride. I told him no, and that I wanted to run here. But he got this new car and offered to give me a ride in it to see how it drives. Then Mitchell drove me here. I really wanted to run here, but he drove me." Mark asks Akinmola, "You know why he drove you here, don't you?" Akinmola asks, "No. Tell me why." Mark, the master of messing with everyone, replies, "He wants you to get out of shape so you won't beat him in the mile." Looking suspiciously at Mitchell, Akinmola replies, "Then I'll run home and go out for a run later." Mitchell tells Akinmola, "He's just messing with you." Mark replies, "No, I'm not." Akinmola, knowing that Mitchell will be running at the university next year, tells Mitchell, "I'll see you on the track in the fall, my friend. We'll see then. Do you understand me?" Mitchell and Akinmola, who extensively trained together while in high school, never cease messing with each other. Today, however, Mark just ignited the fire that will lead to more intense competition between Mitchell and Akinmola. Kathy, listening to the conversation, exclaims, "What? Is there something I don't know about?" Akinmola replies, "I got a dual enrollment, so I am going to two schools. I take my core classes at the university, and I run track there. And I take my seminary classes at the seminary." Kathy, in amazement, asks, "How did you manage that?" Akinmola explains, "I went to the university and put in my application. With my application, I put pictures of my gold medals from the state meets in the mile and half mile. They called me in last week. Dr. Braun remembered me from your party." Kathy exclaims, "That's great. I can't believe it. We're all going to be together again next year." Everyone is surprised and very happy to hear the good news. Lena Borg, now the head lifeguard at the county pool, comes over to talk with Tessa. Lena and Tessa were on the swimming team together for a few years in high school. Knowing that Tessa was the team's best swimmer last year, Lena asks, did you get a scholarship anywhere? Tessa lets Lena know, yeah. I got a full scholarship to the state university. Jimmy will be running track there. And I got two other offers, but the others were only partial scholarships. Lena tells Tessa, well, I guess we'll be swimming against each other at some point. Tessa exclaims, wow. I didn't put that together. Lena explains, you'll quickly find out that you'll be swimming against some of your former teammates, like me. And, believe it or not, some of the people you swam against in high school might actually be on your team. In a sudden sense of amazement, Tessa replies, wow. I never thought of that either. Lena then asks, are you and Eddie racing today? Tessa replies, yeah. Last year, Eddie won. I hope he hasn't been practicing. Lena tells Tessa, well, you're due to beat him then. Tessa explains, last year, when Eddie was a senior, he came to swim team tryouts. He broke the state record in the 50 and in the 100 freestyle. He said he just wanted to know where he stands. Miss Hamilton was blown out of the water. Then, Eddie went back to running track. Lena exclaims, you can't be serious. Tessa replies, he did. Hearing all of Tessa's news, Lena asks, do you mind if I race with you guys this year? Tessa grins and replies, not at all. We can double team him. Lena then tells Tessa, just let me know when you guys want to swim. Lena, who will be swimming against Tessa next year, wants to join the race to know exactly where she stands. Right before lunch, the day's big event arrives. Lena blows her whistle, announcing that the pool will be closed for 10 minutes. It takes 10 minutes for everyone to get out of the pool, with the younger kids moving as slow as a turtle. Once everyone is out of the water, Eddie and Tessa move to the pool's edge, ready to race. Eddie even lets Tessa choose her lane. Lena joins them, but there are no other competitors this year. With Tessa in lane 3, Eddie in lane 5, and Lena in lane 4, everyone is ready to go. Andrea, the other lifeguard on duty today, tells everyone to get ready. Perceiving that a race is about to begin, a few spectators line the side of the pool. Andrea asks if everyone is ready, which they are. Andrea announces, "Take your mark." Once everyone is set, Andrea blows her whistle. Eddie, Tessa, and Lena dive into the water, all knowing a lot is at stake in this race. As Eddie and Tessa fight it out, Tessa has a slight lead over Eddie during the first lap. Lena is right there with them. Tessa, realizing that she stands a chance to win this year, gives it all she has. Lena also gives it all she has, knowing that she is up against the state's gold medalist in the 100-yard freestyle. At the wall, Tessa arrives first, with Eddie and Lena tied. After everyone does their flip turn, Eddie has a slight lead. During the second lap, Eddie has a slight advantage. Tessa and Lena, however, are gaining ground on Eddie. Somehow, Lena emerges as the leader during mid-lap. With the lead frequently changing, it's still anyone's race. At the wall, as far as anyone can tell, it's a three-way tie. During the third lap, the pool is lined with even more spectators. Tessa is not about to let Eddie win again this year. And Lena is not about to let Tessa win either. But during the third lap, Eddie has a slight lead. As they all approach the wall, Tessa and Lena erode away at Eddie's lead, but they both know Eddie's greatest strength is in his flip turn. Knowing this, at the wall, Tessa and Lena kick off, as if they are the ones trying to break the concrete. After kicking off the wall together, Tessa emerges as the leader. As best anyone can tell, Eddie and Lena are tied as they both fight it out to beat Tessa. Tessa, not knowing where she stands, is out to kick ass. Approaching the wall, Tessa touches first, with Eddie and Lena apparently tied for second place. The crowd cheers, many of them not even knowing the level of competition they have just witnessed. Kathy, who timed the race, announces, with a time of 49.8 seconds, Tessa won. Eddie and Lena tied, as far as I can tell. They both swam a 50.0. Eddie and Lena congratulate Tessa, as everyone exchanges high fives in the pool. Hearing the times, Lena tells Tessa, "For an unofficial race, we all turned in great times." Lena and Tessa are both faster than they were last year. Eddie turned in a time slower than last year, but he has been more focused on running over the past few months. The swimmers get out of the pool and head back to the tables. Everyone congratulates Eddie and Tessa, who provided everyone at the pool a few minutes of entertainment today. But now that the race is over, everyone makes their way to the concession stand to find lunch. Lunch is pizza, which is not surprising for this group. Over lunch, Mitchell and Akinmola are having a discussion about the mile. Wanting some information, Akinmola asks Mitchell, "So, what are you running the mile in now?" Acting as if it's nothing special, Mitchell replies, "At the university, I ran a 3:57.5. But I might be a little faster now." Akinmola replies, "That's really fast, my man." Akinmola, who asks many questions, asks, "How about everyone else at the school? How fast do they run?" Mitchell informs Akinmola, "Daryl Stone runs just under 4 minutes consistently. But he's faster now that he's been using Eddie's training sled. I think he ran about 3:58 in one meet I watched. But I can still beat him." Mitchell is highly confident in himself. Even if Stone is a little faster, Mitchell is still able to beat him by strategy. Mitchell then asks, "So, what are your times these days?" Changing the subject, Akinmola asks, "What is this training sled you are talking about?" Mitchell explains, "It's a sled with weights on it. You put on the harness and run in the sand. It simulates running against resistance." Akinmola comments, "I'd like to try it sometime. Where do I find one?" Mitchell tells Akinmola, "It's part of the training at the university now. I hear Eddie made 4 of them for the university. He also made 1 for Erika, Tessa, and John. I also hear that everyone who's used it has had their times come down." Mitchell then asks again, "How are your times these days?" Akinmola replies, "I need to find Eddie and find out about this training sled. Please excuse me, my friend." Akinmola realizes that his 4-minute, 10-second mile might not be as competitive as needed for college, so he avoids Mitchell's question and looks for Eddie. Akinmola, finding Eddie, asks, "Hey, I hear you have a training sled. Can I try it out sometime?" Eddie replies, "Sure, if you want to. But it works best if you use it in sand, so you have to get it to the beach or to the sand track." Akinmola suggests, "Maybe Mitchell can take me there and we can train together." Eddie mentions, "Either that, or I can take you to the sand track someday. The university team will start training soon, and you'll also have a lot of chances to use it then." Akinmola realizes he has to shave off 10 or 15 seconds off of his mile time to truly be competitive. With 2 runners competing at the sub-4-minute pace, Akinmola must step up his game. Settling for 3rd place is not exactly on Akinmola's list of things to do. Akinmola, looking for more ways to improve his times, asks Eddie, "So, tell me, my friend, how much does your training sled improve the runner's times?" Quick with the answer only because Kathy, the keeper of statistics, has already figured it out, Eddie replies, "Somewhere between 4 and 12% over using it 2 or 3 times a week for 6 months." Kathy figured it out. But that's using the training sled along with Mr. Fraser's interval training drill. Akinmola does some quick math in his head and figures 5% will be 3 seconds per mile, bringing his times to a more competitive sub-4-minute pace. Akinmola, asking even more questions, asks, "Are you serious, man? How can that be? Eddie explains, like he did to Tessa a year ago, when I was in high school, at the track meets, everyone points at me and says, "That's Eddie. He's the fastest guy in the country." I know what they say because I hear it. They all must think I run from when the sun comes up until the sun goes down. What they don't know is that I really don't like running, so I look for shortcuts. The only reason I run fast is because of all the other things I do. The training sled is one of those shortcuts. Running in the sand and bicycling are some of the other ones. Akinmola insists, "I need to try this soon. When can we do it?" Eddie replies, "Call me sometime this week. Either me or Mitchell can take you to the sand track at the university." Looking for a way to improve his performance, Akinmola quickly takes Eddie up on his offer. A while later, when the girls are hanging out at the tables, some of the guys hang out in the pool, talking about their years of running track while they were in high school. Braden asks Eddie, "Are you still training on your bicycle?" Eddie replies, "Yeah. I've stepped it up a bit over the last month or two. We officially start training with the team in a few weeks, and I want to be in top shape." Johnson comments, "That's because he's afraid McCrutchen might beat him." Eddie laughs and replies, "Yeah, right. That's never going to happen." Braden asks Mark, "Are you still training on your bicycle?" Mark replies, "Yeah. Me and Paula ride to the beach and back a lot. Sometimes Eddie and Kathy come with us." Braden, who is considering buying a better bicycle, asks Johnson, "Where did you get that nice bike you got?" Johnson replies, "I built it myself over the past few years." Eddie, who already knows the story behind Johnson's bicycle, smiles and asks, "You built it over a few years? Really?" Astutely perceiving that Eddie is messing with him, Johnson replies, "Yeah." Eddie laughs and asks, "Why didn't you just build it all at once?" Evading the question, Johnson replies, "Some things are really complicated." Johnson, who didn't want to explain how and why he built a bicycle over a period of years, hopes the conversation will move on to another topic. Having no such luck in getting out of explaining the story behind his bicycle, Braden asks Johnson, "I want to hear this. How did it take you years to build your bicycle?" Still messing with Johnson, Eddie comments, "I really want to hear this too." Johnson explains, "Okay. My parents got me a 10-speed when I was in 8th grade. But it wasn't what I really wanted. I rode that bicycle to my grandparents' house to cut their lawn. And it was 10 miles in each direction. So, I wanted a better bicycle, one that's a lot lighter with better components. But it wasn't like my parents were going to go out and buy me a new bicycle just because I wanted a better one." Braden asks, "So, what did you do about it? That's a really nice bike you got now." Johnson continues, "Since I obviously wasn't getting a new bicycle anytime soon, I systematically broke the parts on my bicycle over a few years. My seat broke first, so my parents got me a good seat with an aluminum alloy seat post. Then, I told my parents I fell, and I bent my handlebar. So, they bought me an aluminum alloy handlebar and stem to replace the steel one that came with the bicycle." Braden interrupts, asking Johnson, "What? You fell on purpose?" Johnson replies, "No. I smashed the handlebar against the brick wall at the middle school and bent it." Johnson now has everyone's interest. Now curious, Mark asks, "How did you break the rest of the bicycle?" Johnson explains, "I rammed the rear derailleur into the curb. I told my parents the front and rear derailleurs have to match, so they were replaced with really nice Campagnolo derailleurs. Then, I hit the curb with my pedal and bent it. I got new cranks and pedals out of that one. A few months later, I told my parents the brakes didn't stop well, and I bent my front rim because I couldn't stop in time. I got new brakes and new front and rear wheels out of that accident. So, by the time I was a senior, everything on my bicycle was replaced." Mark asks Johnson, "How did you bend your rim?" Johnson replies, "I ran it into the curb, over and over. I bent the rim so good that I had to walk my bicycle home. It was too lopsided to ride. And if I can't ride my bicycle, that means I can't ride to my grandparents' house to cut their lawn. So, it didn't take too long for my parents to get me two new wheels and brakes that stop well." Having seen the nice bicycle frame Johnson has, Mark asks, "How did you get a new frame?" Johnson replies, "That was a little more complicated. Actually, it was a whole lot more complicated. I couldn't exactly destroy my frame, so I had to come up with a different plan. I bought a frame from Vito, using my own money. I had to get a frame the same color as my old one, or otherwise my parents would have noticed. Then, I rode over to Eddie's house with my new frame. We took all the components off my old frame and put them on my new frame." Still messing with Johnson, Eddie interjects, "Wow. I remember that now. I thought you'd never get away with that." Johnson continues, "So, then I junked my old frame. My parents never did figure out that the bicycle I was riding was not the one they bought for me when I was in 8th grade. So, the bicycle I have right now is totally built with replacement parts." Eddie laughs, prompting Mark to tell Eddie, "That's about as bad as that shit you pulled with your piano lessons." Staring at Eddie as if Eddie is from a different planet, Braden exclaims, "What? You took piano lessons?" Eddie replies, "Yeah. When I was in the 4th grade, my parents made me take piano lessons." Braden comments, "I never knew that." Eddie replies, "Some things you just want to forget. Piano lessons are one of them. Piano lessons weren't exactly on the top of my list of things to do." Braden asks, "How did you get out of taking piano lessons?" Eddie begins explaining, "The teacher, Mrs. Hildebrand, was a real pain in the ass. She was supposedly some sort of concert pianist from Great Britain. She must have been like 90 years old or something, and she had 4 pairs of glasses. Oh, and she was always cold. She even wore a sweater in the summer. And in the winter, she was always asking my mother to turn up the heat." Braden exclaims, "I'm glad I didn't get no piano lessons." Eddie continues, "When I was playing, she would count over and over, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. She was a human metronome. So, just to annoy her, I started playing the left hand and the right hand like an 8th step off from each other. It drove her crazy. But that didn't work. She kept coming back every week. The next thing I tried was playing what should be played with the left hand with my right hand. And what I should have been playing with my right hand, I played with my left. That drove her crazy too. I was so happy when I heard Mrs. Hildebrand tell my mother, 'This kid has no talent.' But she kept coming back every week." Braden then asks, "How did you finally get rid of her?" Eddie explains, "When she was leaving one day, she told me, 'Will you please go and fetch my jersey?' I asked her, 'What's a jersey?' Sounding like an old school teacher, she told me, 'My sweater.' Don't tell me you've never heard of a jersey. Jersey and sweater are interchangeable. So, I told her, 'Fine, then. New jersey, new sweater, what's the difference?' 'I'm moving to new sweater.' Then, I asked her, 'What brand of Hildy are you, anyway?' So, she got really mad that I made fun of her name. Then, when she was leaving, she told my mother, 'You shouldn't really waste your money on piano lessons for that lad. Edward has absolutely no talent. There is no hope for him.' So, the next week, Mrs. Hildebrand didn't show up. I was so happy." Mark laughs, asking Eddie, "She called you a lad?" Eddie replies, "Yeah. She can call me whatever she wants to, just as long as she never came back." Braden asks Mitchell, "Speaking about lessons, how are the martial arts lessons going?" Mitchell replies, "I'm working on my 4th level black belt. It's probably going to take a few years. Bobby B. comments, I remember when you started taking lessons. That was back when we were all freshmen. Mark mentions, that's really fast, going from zero to third level black belt in 4 years. Mitchell replies, in my school, you have to fight off 3 first level black belts to earn your third level black belt. That's usually the big challenge for most students. I fought off 3 first level black belts when I was at the second level. So, I guess that put me on the fast track. Eddie asks, by the way, how are Colin and Royza doing these days? Bobby B. asks, who are Colin and Royza? Eddie replies, Joey Colin and Mike Royza. Those are the 2 guys we ran into during the first week of school when we were freshmen. They are the 2 guys we caught messing with Mitchell when we were walking home that day. Bobby B. exclaims, I remember that. You worked those guys over good. Mitchell explains, when I was a junior, I ran into those guys again. I was walking home after school one day, and those 2 guys came out from behind the bridge abutment near the middle school and tried to shake me down. They didn't get too far. Always wanting to be on top of any news about an ass kicking, Braden asks, what happened? I wanna hear this. Mitchell replies, you don't want to hear it. It wasn't that big of a deal. Braden insists, sure I do. Mark tells Braden, I want to hear this too. I've never heard about Mitchell kicking anyone's ass. Mitchell explains, it was dark out, and I was walking home after track practice. Amber had an orthodontist appointment that day, so her mother picked her up after practice to take her there. I walked under the bridge near the middle school, and Colin, the bigger one, approached me with a knife. I greeted him with a flying 2-point move. In the first move, I kicked his knife out of his hand. The knife went flying. In the second move, I kicked him upside his head. He landed on the ground. Braden exclaims, wait a second. You did all that shit when you were in the air. Mitchell replies, yeah, bro. That's what we do in karate. Mitchell continues, then Royza, the fat guy, came after me. He was wildly throwing punches. I was messing with him, evading every punch. Then Colin gets up and rushes me. I picked him up and threw him up against the bridge abutment. Royza came after me again. Royza was a little easier to take care of. I smashed his face into the bridge abutment a few times and rubbed it into the concrete until it bled. Then, I left them lying on the ground, and I walked home. Braden exclaims, I wish I was there to see that ass kicking. Mitchell again states, it wasn't really a big deal. Not to a third level black belt, anyway. Mark asks, what happened after that? Mitchell explains, apparently, they didn't know who I was. But, I remembered who they were. I didn't see either of them around the school for a few days. Then, I passed them in the hallway, and Royza was looking really rough. Neither of them said anything to me, so I figured they had no idea who took them down. Braden points out, that's more than a takedown. That's a major league ass kicking. Kathy then yells out to the guys, hey. We're packing up. It's time to head out and get pizza. As the guys get out of the pool, Mitchell tells Eddie, let me show you the new car I got. Eddie asks, what did you get? Mitchell replies, it's a surprise. The guys head out, all interested to see what kind of car Mitchell bought. Now that the party is over, Eddie, along with a few others, walks out to the parking lot to take a look at Mitchell's newly acquired vehicle. Eddie takes a look, as Mitchell tells him, I paid $1,200 for it. Looking over the vehicle, Eddie replies, it looks like you got a good deal. The body looks like it's in perfect condition. Eddie then asks Mitchell, how does it run? Mitchell replies, so far, so good. Can you check it out for me sometime? Eddie replies, sure. Bring it by the station, and we'll take a look at it. Mitchell bought the 4-year-old German-built Opel 1900 from another college student, who just graduated. With only 25,000 miles on it, the car looked like a really good deal to Mitchell. Now that the party is over, the next party begins. Everyone heads over to the pizzeria. Akinmola hitches a ride with Mitchell, only because everyone will be finished eating by the time Akinmola would get there if he ran. In the parking lot, Tessa tells Eddie and Kathy, "Hey, I just want to thank you guys for helping me with my swimming over the past few years." Eddie replies, "No problem." Tessa explains, "No, really. If it wasn't for you guys, I probably wouldn't have gotten a scholarship. 4 years ago, you guys taught me how to do a flip turn. And then Barbara found out that I needed to work on my kick off the wall, and you guys told me how to do that." Tessa gives Eddie and Kathy a hug, telling them, "Thank you guys so much." They then head to the pizzeria with the rest of the group. When Eddie and Kathy get home from dinner, out of the blue, Kathy exclaims, "Hey, buddy. Where's my June buggy?" Eddie replies, "Oh yeah. We were in the middle of building that." Kathy asks, "How do you mean, we?" Eddie replies, "Well, you did pick out the color, and you got the registration." Kathy asks, "Oh yeah. I did. So, what's left to do?" Eddie explains, "It's almost done. I have to install the seats, wire up the gauges, and then I have to take it over to the station and do a wheel alignment." Waiting almost a year for her June buggy, Kathy asks, "How long will all that take?" Eddie, pretending like he is thinking about it, tells her, "About a day." Kathy asks, "Then, how are we not like done?" Eddie tells her, "If you asked me next week, I would have told you it was done." Kathy replies, "Oh yeah. Duh."